Welcome, everyone, to the Top Producer Podcast. I am Paul Neath, your host, and today we're going to have a conversation with Tom Herron, who is the owner of Ag Professionals based in, well, I'll let him explain where he's based and all that good stuff. So, Tom, how are things going today?
Good, Paul. Thank you. Very good to talk to you today.
And you are currently, or where you're based is in Colorado, is that correct?
Correct. Our headquarter office is in Greeley, Colorado, with another office in Twin Falls, Idaho, and remote folks from Kansas, East Texas, all the way up into Washington and Oregon.
Okay. Well, as we're taping this, I was actually in Phoenix this morning, and yesterday in Phoenix, it was 95 degrees. And as we're taping this in Colorado, it's about 35 degrees. So a little bit difference on the weather outlook.
And expecting snow tonight. Yes.
Yep. So there was a chance I was going to be in a golf event tomorrow, and I'm glad that I ended up not doing that because it was not going to be fun. But enough about golf and so on. But I'd like to do on these podcasts is start off with your background as far as where you grew up and went to college, and maybe your background before you got involved or started ag professionals. So let's go ahead and start with that.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Western North Carolina, right next to the Blue Ridge Mountains, not too far off of the Blue Ridge Parkway. And all my family is from East Tennessee, Western North Carolina. So we grew up small family farms. We had cows and chickens and pigs and hay and everything else, except the only thing we made money on was tobacco.
Yep.
So grew up setting tobacco in the spring and topping it in the fall. We'd get out of school. It was almost a school holiday because there were so many kids that were out having to help on the farm with tobacco. So I grew up back east. I went to college at Appalachian State originally in Boone, North Carolina. I ended up at Colorado State University a couple of years later. So I am what's known as a hillbilly from the hills of East Tennessee and the Smoky Mountains of Western North Carolina.
So I'm just curious, Boone, North Carolina to Fort Collins, Colorado. How did that happen?
Well, I loved agriculture, and my grandmother just always told me, get out of agriculture. There's no money in it. Don't be poor like us. Of course, telling me what to do is exactly the wrong thing. I wanted nothing else. But finding my way in agriculture, I started actually being in ranching and horses and thought I was going to be a cowboy and mostly manual labor on farms and ranches. And I headed out west to the big sky country with ideas of Wyoming and Montana in my head. And how did I get here? I ran out of money in Fort Collins, Colorado, and that's where I stuck.
I'm actually impressed you made it that far then. So
I had an old Ford diesel that got decent gas mileage, but didn't like the 10 degree below weather out here in the altitude. But I made it that far on about $600, got a pitcher of beer and a newspaper and found a want ad for somebody needing horse training in Fort Collins. And I have been here ever since.
Okay. And I think, based on our discussions offline, you were pretty involved with horses for quite a while. Is that correct?
I was. Everything from breeding and show horses to the cutting and the reining, all the way up into the hunter jumpers. So I did the horses for quite a while. Hard to make a living.
Yes. I tell people, being a CPA, I've talked to lots of people that raise horses or are talking about raising horses. And I go, and maybe I shouldn't make a joke like this, but I'm like, you could have a cocaine habit and you'll spend less money on the cocaine habit than you will on the horse habit.
Probably safer too. Yes, that's interesting. So, being in Fort Collins, there's a lot of large agriculture out here in the West, in Colorado, and driving through Kansas, Nebraska, and spending time all the way down in Texas, you know, I saw how large agriculture was out here and kind of made my way over more into the commercial commodity production side of agriculture.
And so when did you, so your current role now is, or the company is Ag Professional. Let's start about the early years, when it started and sort of how it evolved in the early years.
Well, when I got out here, I was in the Army in between Appalachian State and Colorado State University. But I went back to school in the late 80s, early 90s, when some of the environmental movement was happening. Went to Front Range Community College and CSU and studied a lot of environmental classes and ended up getting a job with a local environmental company who did mostly hazardous waste and commercial industrial type things, which weren't terribly appealing to me, but it was an interesting job. I tried to talk to my employer about, you know, hey, there's a whole nother industry called agriculture out here that's starting to get some environmental pressures from EPA and CAFO permits and things like that. And, you know, they told me what my grandmother told me. They kind of said, there's no money in agriculture. So they blew me off. But in order to get me to shut up, they agreed to let me join a trade association that my boss had met through the rodeo or rotary breakfast one time. So they let me join the Colorado Cattle Feeders Association. It was kind of their way of appeasing me. And my very first board meeting and committee meeting I went to, the association was debating and voted on creating a brand new position, an environmental and natural resource position for the Colorado Cattle Feeders Association. So I was on the committee voting to create this new position. And the very next day I put my application in. So that's where I kind of got into more of the commercial agriculture and the environmental and the political side as well, because a lot of what I was doing was lobbying and working on legislation or either advocating or fighting against legislation. A lot of regulatory rulemakings were growing at the time regarding agriculture. And I was in the middle of that when it really first started getting heavy in the late 80s and early 90s. And my environmental natural resource backgrounds just evolved from there in the last 30 years.
Okay. So how long were you in that role? And then from that role, is that when you decided to start Ag Professionals?
It was. At the time, you know, Texas Cattle Feeders had created an environmental position. Kansas Livestock Association had created an environmental position. Nebraska did the same because, you know, we all stayed in touch with each other, especially through National Cattlemen's. So we got the idea, the Livestock Association, instead of just providing information to our members, we wanted to provide advice. And at the time, the lawyer said, well, you too much liability. You can't be providing advice. So to get around that, we decided to create a separate company, an LLC. At the time, it was called EnviroStock, in order to separate that from the trade association, which seemed to be a really good idea. In hindsight, a for-profit company owned by a nonprofit that's managed by a board of farmers that rotate every year turned out not to be the best structure to grow a fledgling business. So
yeah, that very rarely works. So I would totally agree with that.
Yep. So my counterpart in Nebraska, he went out and started his own company. Kansas Livestock still has a relationship with an internal or semi-internal company. And I was sticking to the cattle feeders. We had EnviroStock and it lasted about 3 years. And we parted ways, and I started Ag Professionals. And about 2 or 3 years later, I bought them out of their remaining company, EnviroStock. And now Ag Professionals, we are in our 25th year.
And so for the listeners on the podcast here, let's dive into what the company does. I mean, we sort of seen how it got started. It's been around for 25 years, but what are the services? Maybe what are the first services you did, and then how has it evolved into the services that you do now?
Well, it started with, you know, as I'm talking to producers about the new regulations and explaining to them, you know, what's entailed and what they need to do. Of course, a smart producer said, well, it seems you know all about it. Why don't you just do it for me? So I was in the regulatory environment doing permitting and CAFO permitting and stormwater work. And as we grew, we needed, you know, we needed engineering, we needed other aspects of the business. But a lot of our growth came out of frustration. For example, our real estate, we have in-house real estate. We have 7 brokers covering most of the Western U.S. And our real estate focus is more site selection. So when we were helping people build new dairies or new feed yards, they were coming to us with a piece of property that they'd just bought. And we had the untenable task of telling them that it wasn't a great site. So the broker sold them a site that, you know, it was in a floodplain or it had high groundwater or we couldn't permit it there. And we tried to work with other real estate companies, but they either didn't treat our clients right, communication was poor, or honestly, some of them kind of tried to screw us over. So we said, okay, we'll bring real estate in-house. And over the years, we've brought environmental in-house. We have most every discipline of engineering. Again, we brought surveying in-house, trying to meet schedules and deadlines and communication. It was hard to subcontract, so we brought surveying in-house. We have a fledgling geotech lab we brought in-house. So we've grown out of somewhat necessity and frustration, but we've turned into a one-stop shop, and it's been really convenient for our clients.
And so your typical client would be, let's say you might have a dairy operation in California, and because of regulations or just the big increase in land prices, they elect to move out of California. So how do you help that dairy then move out of California or wherever it might be?
Well, we were a major player in the exodus from the Chino area. We had a lot of clients from that area in San Jacinto, and eventually it kind of worked on up the valley, Visalia, Bakersfield, all the way to Chowchilla. But, you know, a client would contact us. We spent a lot of time with the family, understanding their business and desires and communities that they wanted to be in. And then we would go find properties. And a lot of these properties weren't even on the market. We would find what we thought were ideal sites that met the family's criteria. We'd go knock on doors. So we would find the locations. We would get them permitted. We would design and engineer the facility. We would help with the owner's representation because a lot of the owners were in California and we were building new facilities out here. But we can do everything from site selection to operation, except we don't build them and we don't operate them. But dairies are about 50% of our business, but we also do beef feedlots, poultry, pork, commercial, and lately we've been doing a lot more renewable energy.
Yeah, and we'll have a separate discussion a little bit on renewable energy later on. So what is the, I think with those markets that you serve, I guess the nice thing about that is maybe when dairy is down, maybe pork or feed or beef cattle is up or poultry is up, and then vice versa. Is that what you've seen over the years?
It is, and I'm thankful every day that we are diversified across the spectrum of agriculture and across most of the country, because if we were specialized in one species or one particular aspect, It can be challenging. So we've remained successful, but when dairy's down, like it has been lately, we've been doing a lot of poultry work. Hadn't had too many beef feed yards the last couple of years, but now with beef prices and inventory, we're seeing a lot more beef work. We had some quite a bit of due diligence and site selection work with USDA sponsoring a lot of these little packing plants that are starting to pop up. But thankfully, we're very diversified both geographically and in agriculture because our fate and fortune relies on the same fate and fortune of our clients. And if they're hurting price-wise and profitability, usually we're right in there with them. So we've ridden out everything from 2011 to the 2008 crash. We've been up and down ourselves. But we've averaged a good 15 to 20% year over year when you look back on the last 25 years.
Well, and that's the thing with ag. When people tell me that this time it's different, we're at the high and this time it's different, I know they're at the high at that point. But also when people say, hey, it can't get any worse, this is as bad as it's ever going to be. And then I also know we're usually at the bottom then. So they just ratchet from high to lows, and that's been true for hundreds, if not thousands of years.
I remember a conversation over the fence with one of my neighbors out in Gilcrest, Colorado, about when corn was $8 and something a couple of years ago. Oh, we'll never see $4 corn again.
We're going to see $3 corn before it's done, probably. We're not that far away, especially cash. I know lots of areas are probably $3 corn right now. So you have a location, your headquarters is in Greeley, Colorado. You have a location in Twin Falls, which I actually have an aunt that lives in Twin Falls, so I've been there several times. Beautiful country. I love Twin Falls. Is there any other parts of the country you're thinking about expanding to?
We've got a footing in Southwest Kansas, down around Syracuse and Garden City. We are looking at South Dakota and the I-29 corridor. We're getting some requests for some help and services out there. And then surprisingly, for dairy and poultry down in Georgia and Florida, they still have a pretty strong milk price. It's a fluid deficit area. It's one area in the country where milk seems to still be growing and still be needed. So we're evaluating our options. You can't do everything all at once, but we're looking at where we're most needed and can serve the most market.
Okay. Well, Tom, I think we're going to go ahead and take a break for a sponsored message, and then we'll come back and have a discussion a little bit on renewable energy and how it may help or hurt ag, and then finish up with my normal questions at the end of a podcast.
Sounds great.
How many years away is the long run for a farmer? 5 years? 10 years? Top producers like Hans Reinschi, a Blue Diamond farming company in Jessup, Iowa, know RoboAgri Finance shares his enduring vision for the future.
Whether it's building our grain site or if it's purchasing the next field, we're able to turn to Rabo as a trusted partner to help us get financing to make those generational decisions.
With unmatched financial capacity, local relationship managers, and a global network of sector experts to offer market guidance, RoboAgri Finance provides enterprising farmers with a personalized approach to lending and financial services. Growing a better world together, RoboAgri Finance.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Top Producer Podcast. I'm Paul Neefe, your host, and we're going to rejoin our conversation with Tom Herron, one of the owners of Ag Professionals based in Greeley, Colorado. Tom, we talked about, really what I would say more the production side of agriculture, but really there's a potential, and I'm going to use the word potential, additional revenue stream that may be coming down the road in the next, you know, 5 or 10 years. And that's in the renewable side, whether, and of course, a lot of farmers have already participated in that. You know, I was lived out in Washington State for many, many years. And the house I was living in before we moved to Colorado, probably within, you know, 50 miles of that house was 2,000 wind turbines. So, you know, and that's primarily on ag land. So you've sort of started to get into that business. For the listeners out there, what are the options for ag, or what is the trends that you're seeing on the renewable side?
Well, again, you know, we have had customers asking and questioning. They read and see and watch TV and hear what's going on with the climate discussion, whichever side of the fence you're on there. So again, we're responding to our clients, looking at the same thing we always have. How do we stay in agriculture? How do we control the fact that we don't have much say over the prices that we get? And part of that is diversify. And we've talked about diversification and what you're growing in agriculture. But another big segment is diversify your income into some kind of renewable or carbon or climate type endeavor. Agriculture owns most of the natural resources around this country, and people are finding out that those resources have value beyond producing corn or cattle. And so in about 2015 or 16, we started getting more and more questions about solar. Of course, you mentioned wind, and we haven't been working in the wind energy market, and don't know how we feel about that. A lot of our clients have mixed feelings on quite a bit of this, as a matter of fact. But if you can diversify your income, and solar is one way to do that. We're on about our 20th anaerobic digester project. We're working in co-digestion, which is manure anaerobic digestion along with food waste. But we're seeing regenerative agriculture practices, carbon sequestration. We're starting to work in those and are part of a USDA grant. If you can diversify your income and put your natural resources to work without impacting your food production, I'm not in favor of, you know, we're not taking out irrigated vegetable ground to put solar panels on, but, you know, anything that can help our clients staying power to be in agriculture longer, keep that next generation on the farm, buy additional land around them, whatever that's going to help their longevity, you know, we're for it. And solar is one of the easier ones to do. You can have a little solar field as small as a couple of acres. We just are in the process of permitting the second half of a solar project in eastern Colorado that's about 9,000 acres. And that is on rangeland that is very poor. It can hardly sustain enough grazing to pay its taxes. And honestly is one of the highest and best uses probably for that property. Digestion is a little more complicated and a lot more expensive. And there's all kinds of companies out there pushing that, but they don't always have their money together. If they need grants or want to partner with you, I would bring up a question about that. But in the right place and the right opportunity, anaerobic digestion or co-digestion, composting organics can be a new revenue stream as well. You know, for most of our row crop farmers, anything regenerative that you're doing, strip-till, no-till, cover crop, you know, it's ironic. The things that we do that are typically good for the land, good for the crops, also are good for the environment. So it's not that big of a stretch to be looking at any of the options and practices in regenerative ag and getting paid for that as well. I think you should get paid for it.
Are there any key pitfalls that let's say a farmer's been approached by a solar developer and they're dangling a lease or dangling some upfront payments. What are some of the pitfalls that farmers should watch out for? Because I know there's a lot of that going on. Matter of fact, I have some ground myself, and I've sort of been peripherally approached, or I could maybe participate at some point in time. And what are some of those key pitfalls you have to watch out for?
Well, one of the first things I would ask is how many projects they have in operation, how long they've been running, because there are a lot of developers that want to tie you up, whether that's get a manure contract on a dairy or tie up your acreage for a solar farm. And their intent is to aggregate those contracts and go out and flip them to a bigger development that actually has the money. But a lot of those upfront guys that are just trying to get you contracted and flip those contracts don't have the money or the horsepower to do the development. So, watch out for, if they're talking pretty quick, my radar goes off. Ask them how many projects they have actually built, how many they're operating, and do they have their money together without the support of grants or subsidies. I think that's important, because if it's relying on grants and subsidies, not that there's anything wrong with that, but the political winds can change, and all of these projects, solar projects, digester projects, are at least 20-year projects. So you may not have the same developer at the end of the project or that you started with. So I encourage our guys to make sure it's real, ask hard questions, ask for as much money that you can get up front, because again, if you're asked to be in a partnership or, profit sharing, that can change with the political winds very quickly. And who knows the longevity of these projects because they're so new, but I encourage our clients to get as much money up front as they can. And it also shows that the developer is real. If they have cash and they think it's such a great deal, then they can pay us for our natural resources up front, because we're not in the energy business. They are. So yeah. they want what our clients have. They need to pony up.
Are there options where, so let's say you have the solar project, it's going to be there for 30 years, and at the end they have to remove the solar panels, and let's say they're long gone, is there options as far as maybe getting a bond or some type of sinking fund for that? Or what have you seen in that area?
Most projects that require any permitting also require a bond. Excuse me. But I would definitely ask, not a lot of people at the beginning of a project think about the exit strategy. But there's so much invested in the infrastructure and the connectivity of the substations or wherever they're putting in these solar projects that it is unlikely they will completely go away. So if the life cycle is 20 years, that developer for some reason doesn't exist, it's highly probable that another developer would come in, install a new updated solar panel because of the infrastructure that's there, and probably continue that project. What I don't want to see our clients dealing with is you end up owning it and trying to run it.
Yeah.
We want to be sure and create a project that avoids, our clients turning into the operator of an anaerobic digester. That's not their core business. And that's a big red flag. So.
And on these rates that we've heard now, I was talking to somebody in central Illinois, excuse me, on good farm ground. That's my concern sometimes in Illinois and some of these other areas, is these projects are going in on good farm ground because that's where the substation or where they can tie into the grid. I'm hearing $2,000, $2,500 per acre rental, and then an escalator. I think other areas maybe 11, 12, 13, 1400. Is that the numbers that you hear too, or what type of numbers have you heard?
Yeah, a couple of years ago on solar, we were seeing $500, $600. Now we're seeing $1,200 to $1,500. I don't think I've seen anything really large scale that's over 2000. But on the smaller community projects, you could probably be looking in at the 2,000 range. There is big money in these projects, or these developers and investors wouldn't be chasing it.
Yeah.
So again, get as much money as you can and get it up front as quick as you can. And if they're for real, they're going to do the math and be able to do that. We do have clients who have gotten large substantial payments up front instead of these longer term rental payments, because there's no guarantee, you know, we're going to be around, they're going to be around 10, 20 years from now. Who can predict? If you can predict ag prices or what's going to happen 2 years from now, you know, I'll give you a quarter, but, you know, 10 or 20 years from now, who knows? Who knows what the politics will be? Who knows what this climate thing will be? So, you know, that would be my advice.
Okay. Yeah. If you can predict what commodity prices are going to be 2 weeks from now, you can make pretty good money, so much less 2 months or 2 years. So, well, Tom, this has been great. I think I'll probably have another podcast with you maybe a year from now and see if some of this stuff has changed. But I always like to end with three or four key questions. So the first is, I'm just curious, did you have any mentor in this process of getting started in your career or getting ag professional started?
I did. I had the CEO of the Colorado Livestock Association at the time, as Colorado Cattle Feeders, Brad Anderson, that was pretty influential with me. Jim Anderson, who was my first feedlot farmer client, the letter he wrote backing the idea was probably what I consider our company charter. And then Trish Spain, who's been with me the last 10 years, was actually my first boss out of community college that got me in the environmental arena. And she agreed to come back and work for me the last 10 years, and she just retired. But I've had some great mentors and wouldn't be where I am without them.
And maybe your grandmother telling you what you couldn't do, that spurred you to do it. So
they definitely did, yes.
Yeah. Now, you know, any entrepreneur running a company, you know, it takes a lot of time, but do you have any hobbies?
I try to. I don't know too many guys you're going to run to, but I play classical music. I've been a pianist since I was five. And I also play guitar, but I like to play music to relax because I can't think of anything else at the same time while I'm playing music.
Yeah.
And then if I'm not doing that, I build cars. I like to build old trucks and old Jeeps. I just bought a 57 FC150 Jeep. I mean, my wife's not real happy that I drug it home, but it'll run someday.
I remember when I first got married, I started a job at Moss Adams in Yakima, and my dad had given me a 1965 Ford F-150 pickup and stick shift, you know, and so on. And this thing, you know, it ran, and I had it in the parking lot, and I come out at the end of the day to get, you know, hop in that pickup and go home, and somebody stole it. Well, the interesting thing was the person, let's just say the person that stole it, what's the correct terminology now? He was mentally challenged, maybe that's the correct terminology, but he had gassed up the pickup, he had washed it, he had cleaned it, he put a new blanket on the seat, and he brought it back to where he stole it from. So it was an interesting process, but I don't build cars myself, and my ability to play a piano is I know how to play Old MacDonald Had a Farm. Somebody, my aunt taught me that when I was like 10 years old, but that's the only skill I have.
Okay. The guy that stole your car can swing by my farm. I got a couple that need washed and gassed up.
I think we all do. So is there anything that keeps you up at night?
You know, as I look back, this shrinking agriculture keeps me up. You know, our mission is to keep clients in agriculture as long as they want to be there. And, you know, the USDA farm report, you know, continues to show that the consolidation and the shrinking in agriculture. And, you know, when I moved to Colorado and started, we had over 400 dairies in Colorado. Now we have about 130. So seeing shrinking agriculture and what can we do about it How do we keep our clients not just subsiding and alive, but prospering? I spend a lot of hours thinking about that.
Yeah. And then finally, what's your definition of success in farming?
It's that staying power, which is all about adaptation and diversifying your income, being creative, doing what we know how to do in ag. And that's make things out of hay twine and baling wire and duct tape, and just being resourceful, adapting, take advantage of these renewables wherever you can diversify your income, or anything else that you can diversify your income. That would be successful.
Yep, totally agree. Tom, is there anything else you'd like to add before we sign off?
Well, I don't think so, but I surely have enjoyed it. Enjoy talking with you.
Yep, same here. Again, this is the Top Producer Podcast, and this is Paul Niefer, your host, signing off.